Thanks for listening to Exploring the Wine Glass podcast, the podcast for people who love wine. I'm Lori Budd, a UC Davis winemaking program and WSET Level 2 graduate. You can find Exploring the Wine Glass on all the socials as well as your favorite podcast catchers. If you haven't subscribed yet, now is the perfect time. I promise I'll never tell you what to drink, but I'll always share what's in my glass. Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in today. I am so excited to share today's episode with you. I am a huge champagne fan. Actually, I am a fan of all bubbles, but there is something about champagne that is special. They will tell you that it's the soil and the weather. They'll tell you that it's the strict regulations on how they process their wine. They'll tell you that it's the pruning methods or the second fermentation in bottle. Well, I cannot guarantee exactly what makes champagne special, but I can guarantee that it is. So when Champagne Pommerais reached out to me to ask if I was interested in interviewing the 10th cellar master and discuss one of the oldest champagne houses, I of course was interested. But when they told me that Champagne Pommerais is now producing California sparkling, let me tell you, it was a no-brainer. I of course wanted to hear and share the story. Please take a moment to subscribe, rate and review Exploring the Wine Glass. And when wine-loving friends ask you what podcast you listen to, we'd appreciate the mention. So now you know, it's time to unscrew, uncork, or savor a bottle, and let's talk champagne. Hey everybody, welcome to this episode of Allure of the Pour, sponsored by Dracena Wines. I'm your host, Lori, a UC Davis winemaking graduate, a WSET Level 2 with distinction graduate, and currently studying champagne through the online program. And I am so excited today because I have the opportunity to amazingly, through the internet, virtually be able to speak to Clément Perlot, who is the cellar master for Champagne Pommerais. And
hello, everybody.
I'm so excited. So welcome, 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 welcome.
Hello, everybody.
So right before we got on, it is 8 o'clock there, 11 a.m. here. So I'm so happy that we were able to get this going. And I want to start off with, first of all, champagne is so incredible. It is so distinct. It is so unique. And as everybody who knows, it can only be called champagne if it's from Champagne. And today we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of Pommerais and how you guys are even more special than just other champagnes that are out there. Let's start off with the history. Champagne Pommerais began when Alexander Louis Pommerais began the business in 1836. So you guys have been around for a really long time. And what was Reims like in those days? And was he one of the first champagne houses back then?
Actually, it was not the first. It was one of the first, but there is some creation of houses in the 18th century. For example, our company owns a brand called 86 Monopole, which was founded in 1785. So it's one of the first in the 19th century, but there were some houses in the 18th century. But you have to know that in the middle of the 19th century, champagne was not a very widespread business. I think we were selling for all the region less than 10 million of bottles in 1850, so it was so small at the middle of the 19th century. And I think Pommerais was one of the company which helped the region to develop the business all over the world. And yes, to be honest, in 1836, the creation of the company was by Narcisse Grenot. He's always forgotten, but when you look at the bottle of Pommerais, you see Pommerais, of course, and you will see just here Greno. So in 1836 was Narcisse Greno, and in 1856 he made a joint venture with Pommery, and but at this time it was really a little company, and unfortunately Mr. Pommery died 2 years after the joint venture. So at this time the company was selling maybe 30,000 bottles. It was very small. It's really Madame Pommery, the widow Pommery, who developed the company.
So what do you know, what were they originally from the area and they decided to start the Champagne House, or was this they traveled to the area in order to start this business?
They were very close to the Champagne area because they were from the Ardennes. It's a little a region near the Belgian border, so it's very close. It's less than 100 kilometers from us, so they were very close. And at this time, the business was more the textile. The business, so they made money in this business.
So I was going to ask you about that because, you know, when I first went to do some research, you know how Wikipedia always comes up first, you know, and I opened it and it was like one little paragraph on the Champagne House, and it said it started as a wool manufacturing company.
Yes.
And I was like, okay, Wikipedia, that's not right.
Mr. Pommery made his fortune in wool.
Oh, all right. So yay to Wikipedia. Didn't have anything else, but they had that. Awesome. Okay. So you had mentioned that Alexandre Pommery had passed away 2 years after this joint venture, and Madame Pommery really, she must have been an incredible woman. Like not only to take on this business, but a brand new business basically, but she really was, it seemed like, to be the heart and soul and the driving force behind the success of this. So, like, are there stories, you know, like, of what an incredible woman she was, or, you know, what else she did? Like,
first of all, she was very strong because she, his daughter was very young when Mr. Pommery died. She was only 39. She had to take the control of the company at 39, in a time where it was very difficult for women to work and obviously to take control of the company. So she was very strong. There is a stories of widows in Japan are very strong. There are other widows, but yes, Madame Pommery was very strong. And in 1870, France was in war. It was so she had to face war too in France. Pommery was occupied by the Prussians, so it was a very bad time for her. So yes, she was first of all very strong, and she was a genius. She has understood everything before everybody. So yes, it's a kind of genius. To know what people want to drink before the others, and how to make sales all over the world.
Was she actively involved in the winemaking process, or was she more business, like this is what we're going to do, or was it a combination of both?
She was more in the sales, but she knows she knows what she wanted. And she gave very precise directives to the cellar master. So her words were very precise on the style of the champagne. It's still the words we are using now, the finesse, the elegance, the freshness. And she gave very precise directives to the first cellar master, Damas. And the second one created the first boat because it took time from the idea of Madame Pommery to the final Brut Nature in 1874, because we started to think on a drier champagne in 1867, I think, when his sales director was in the UK and was feeling that the British needed drier champagne. So it takes around 10 years to develop and to make the wine.
Okay. And one of the things that she was so dead set on was that England was really the place that you had to get to in order to make the Champagne House be successful. And she was very determined to get there. What was it about England that she felt was so important that you created the success there and got your wines there?
At this time, you know, there were two big empires, France, of course, and England, because at this time, England made the trend. So she understood that if the English people were happy, she could sell all over the world. So the British made the trend, so she had to go in this direction.
And was that, I mean, to me, that seems like that was a bold, a brazen thing for a woman to do. But she apparently was very strong, she was also very intelligent, because she aligned herself with very good business men. And they played an important role in this. And Henry Vasmier and Adolf Hubner, if I'm saying it probably very incorrectly.
Henri Vanier, which was the CEO of Madame Pommery, and Adolf Hubner, the sales director. But you have to know, when she takes the control of the company, Henri Vanier was 24, and Hubner 23, or 24 or 23. So they were very young. So she had the genius to hire very young people, because she knew that she needed to be very modern and very innovative. And with the owner of Pommery currently, Mr. Franken and Mr. Roken, he do a bit the same, because he is hiring a lot of young people, young winemakers or engineers, because as Madame Pommery knows that we want to be innovative, we need to hire young people.
Yeah, and I mean, that's true then, that's true today. You have to keep staying on top of things. You have to be new and innovative, but with champagne, it's so traditional. So that's got to be a very fine line to walk.
We say in French that we have the tradition of innovation, and that we are innovative by tradition.
Yes, that's awesome. That's awesome. Okay, so the Pommery estate is listed actually as a historic site. So, I mean, you always see the World Heritage Site, UNESCO World Heritage Site. What actually has to happen in order for a site to be recognized?
Actually, it's all the Champagne region, which is listed on the World Heritage, but it's linked to very precise place in Champagne. It's linked to three places: the Champagne Avenue in Epernay, the historical slopes of Poteau in Ailly and Auvillé, and for us, of course, the Butte Saint-Nicaise. The Butte Saint-Nicaise is where Pommery is. It's a hill where you have very ex- extraordinary choke carries from the Galo women. And especially in Pommery, we have very particular sellers, natural sellers in the choke, going from all the choke carries. We have more than 18 kilometers of galleries, 30 meters under earth. So it's something I think we can do now. It was amazing to do that at, in the 19th century. So that's why this place is very particular. And you have on the top the estate, very original estate, very big. It's more than 50 hectares, in acres, I think it's 120 acres. With a very particular building in the British style. We call this a neo-Elizabethan style. So it's really a very original building.
I feel like I'm stupid for asking this question though, but how does one get to be that? Is there a board that comes in and declares this region as a World Heritage Site?
It's a very long process. I think it took 10 years from the beginning of the idea to the listing. It's an official listing from the UNESCO board. Yes.
Right. So somebody at some point basically puts in as a request to be acknowledged, and then it's a process that you go through, and UNESCO decides yes or no.
Yeah, you have to explain why you want to be listed, because you have different categories, and they come to visit the particular places, and it's a long
process. And at the heart of your champagne house is the vineyard Clos Pompadour of Domaine Pommery. So what is so special about that particular vineyard site?
It's very special because it's a clos. A clos in French is a vineyard surrounded by walls. We have more than 3 kilometers of walls. It's 25 hectares, so in acres. maybe 60 acres. Okay. It's the largest clos in Champagne. It's inside the city of France, so it's very particular vineyard. It's a kind of biodiversity garden in the middle of the city. It's in, on the top of the hill, on the top of the Butte Saint-Nicaise, so it's only choke. So the terroir is very particular. With the walls, you have a microclimate, and it's a historical vineyard because the first harvest. We have some evidence of the first harvest in 1896. This vineyard was the property of Henri Vanier, the CEO of Pommery, and he crossed World War One, World War Two. During the World War One. It has been bombed, and they continue to cultivate the vineyard, so it's a very, very strong history. It's a particular vine too, because most of the vineyard has been replanted in the 60s, and at this time there weren't any clones, you know. So it's what we call a massal selection. So each vine is different from the other, and it's really an historical selection of Pommery. So yes, we have the terroir, we have the microclimate, we have the vines. So we try to do a good wine.
That is pretty darn special. So going back to the size of it, when it was first purchased, was it a smaller site that they've gradually increased, or? Did they purchase this whole region there?
You mean the Pommery estate?
Yes.
She bought all the estate because at this time it was a place where nobody wanted the place because outside the city we got a lot of chokeries. It was just nobody wanted. So the genius of Pommery was to buy this place and make something magnificent.
So all of the property is still the original property?
Yes, yes.
Wow.
It has been built between 1868 and 1878. Of course, during World War One, it has been partially destroyed, but it has been rebuilt exactly the same original.
So for those who have not been lucky enough to visit the area, how easy is it for people to get there? And in terms of Pare, can they, is it a walk-in? You know, not talking pandemic times. Typically, is it walk-in? Is it appointment only? What can they expect if they come to the estate?
It's very easy to reach us because we are at the, as I told you, we formerly at the beginning was outside the city, so now it's inside, but it's at the entrance of France. So it's very easy to reach. We have a big parking, so no problem. You can come by car, by bus, there's no problem. We have different types of visit. You can do the visit by yourself with your smartphone because you can walk the gallery with your smartphone, and we have a tour with your smartphone.
Oh wow!
You can make a guided visit with a hostess. Who knows very well the history and the cellar. We have both a visit, and you have also visits with the vineyard, visit with the winery, and you can also visit the Villa Demoiselle, which is one of the best examples of new art in France. It's a very nice villa. Which was the house of Henri Regnier, the CEO from.
And then when they come in and taste, is it a flight? Is it like how do they come in? And what are they tasting? Take us through a tasting setup.
There is a tasting after each visit, of course. You can taste, of course, the Côte Royale, the Blanc de Blanc. Depending on the tour, depending on the visit, can get to the point.
And how far away, like if they were visiting Pomeray, like can they visit another house afterwards? Like, are you're in the city now, so.
Of course, you can visit other houses, but I.
We don't want to. We want to stay with you. But I'm just saying, like, what if a visitor was coming? What I'm trying to get them to understand. In a day, what should they expect? Like, how long would your tour take?
You need 2 hours for Pomeray because to do it properly, you need 2 hours. And you can visit the cathedral. There are nice museums in France. Of course, you have our colleagues of other houses close. So yes, you can combine okay. with other houses.
Okay, but they should expect 2 hours about with you.
Yeah, you can do it shorter, of course.
But they're not going to want to leave. They're not going to want to leave.
Depending on what you want to see, if you only do the cellars, it could be 45 minutes.
Okay.
But if you want to do the villa or the vineyard or the winery, it would take.
Okay, excellent. So you guys actually, I totally believe in pursue your passion. Okay, but Madame Pomeray stated, you might be passionate, but without perfection and discipline, you cannot attain ultimate. So that is a very high standard to be held to. So what does this motto mean to you as the cellar master? Like, what does it mean to you to have this as the ultimatum of how to make the wine for Champagne Pomeray?
Yeah, so passion is very important, but without discipline and perfection, you can do nothing. You have to be committed to your job at Pomeray because you are here after a lot of people, a lot of passionate people who created the brand, who developed the brand, and people will be after you, and you have a kind of legacy. So yes, you have to have discipline, and in Pomeray it's from from the wine grower who prunes the vines to the person who put the label, everybody is very committed to the brand. And even the wine growers, you know, we have our own vineyard, we also purchase great wine growers. We have families who sell the grape from me since 3 or 4 generations. And they are also committed to the brand, and they want to deliver the best grapes possible every year. So, yes. And during the production and the winemaking, you have to be very precise. And of course, there are very special. There is a kind of art when we do the blend, but it's more a lot of small details that make the blend.
Right. So small details are what makes the big differences. So some of the listeners are new to wine and may not understand the actual concept of what is champagne, or in this realm, just what is a sparkling, what makes a sparkling, what is the difference between champagne and a still wine. So in a brief overview, can you kind of give us the difference? Like, we have a still wine, how do we go from a still wine to a champagne or a sparkling wine? What makes that difference?
First of all, to make champagne, you need a still wine. So yes, you have we are making a still wine from the harvest until March, April. We are working on the still wines, which we call vin clair in French, vin clair, clear wines. And after we will do what we call a second fermentation inside the bottle. The idea is to put yeasts and sugar in the bottle, to close the bottle with a cap, to be very simple. And when the yeast ferments the sugar, you have a liberation of dioxide, carbon dioxide, and as it's closed with a cap, all the that carbon dioxide is in the bottle, and it's how we created the pressure and the bubbles. So that's really the very easy way to explain what a sparkling wine is.
And you're riddling? Is it by hand, or do you have the machine? I never remember the technical term for the machine. The riddling?
As riddling, traditionally it's by hand, but since a long time we invent a machine to copy what we do with by hand. It's called Giro Palette. So it's pages which turn like when you do with the bottle, it's the same thing. The difference is that it's more precise. You can do more bottles at the same time, and the reading is shorter with a machine than hand. But it's more easy to do a quarter turn with a machine than by hand. When you have to riddle 50,000 bottles, it's a long right. job. So I think it's a good thing we have those machines. But we are still doing by hand for big bottles, you know, for Matusalem, Salmanazar, right. By hand.
That would be awesome to see that. That would really be really cool to see.
You have to come with everything okay. will be behind us.
Okay, you're not going to have to twist my arm too hard to come visit. It's really... what's your production...
For Pommery?
Yes.
For Pommery, we can talk, well, there is no absolute rule, but we can talk about around 4 million bottles.
For Pommery?
Yeah.
And so since the champagne needs the still wine first before it becomes the sparkling, does Pommery produce any still wines, or is it a complete champagne house?
We used to, because we used to make a lot of different things in Pomerie. We made red wines. We made ratafia from Champagne. We made some what we call Fine, which is a brandy, a kind of brandy. It was in the 70s, but you know, brandy are not so trendy, and red wines, it's not really the region to make wine. So the red wine Champagne can be very good, but we stopped. We are still making red wine, but only for blending for all rosé wine.
Excellent. And I thought this was really an intriguing fact, is Pomerie actually has the distinction of introducing Brut, the concept of a Brut champagne. And once again, that was Madame Pomerie's, you know, understanding of what the future was to be held. So, like, what did she notice? What did she see that created this? And how did she determine that it should be a Brut, or name it a Brut? What?
We always say that she created the Brut. The reality is that I think a lot of people was thinking of doing a Brut because yes, English people was asking for drier champagne, but the problem at this time is that sugar was here to hide something. You know, it was in 19th century. Harvest was very tough, less ripeness than now. So the champagne were very acid, very arch, so they needed sugar to combine everything, and there were a lot of sugar in the wines, more than 150 grams per liter. It was crazy. So yes, the idea, I think a lot of people was thinking it would be good to have Royal Champagne. So she believed in that, and she put everything in line to do it. It was very expensive, it was very risky. So she decided to purchase, for example, to purchase vineyards, first of all, but also to purchase the grapes to the wine growers directly on the vines. So not on the press center, but directly on the vines. To say that she was taking the risk of the harvest for the wine growers. So she could decide when to pick, when it's ripe or not. So right. It was really very important for her. And what was important too, this estate, this big estate, was here, of course, to pay homage to the British clients, but it was moreover for aging. She needed place to age. At this time, the wine was in barrels, so she needed place to age in barrels, and she needed place to age in bottles. Because what is important is to have ripe grapes for the wine, but you need to age the wines in barrels to make it rounder, and you need a long aging in bottles to make it rounder and more complex and less acid. So she, with 18 kilometers of barrel, we can store 30 millions of bottles in our cellars. And at this time, she created this garage. She was selling less than 2 millions of bottles, and she created a cellar for 30 millions. So she has in mind that to reach the goal of the Brut Nature, she needed spaces, and she needed to make everything great and very precisely. So she had the idea, but she had the courage to make a lot of investments in the buildings and the purchasing of grapes.
And so that's a big difference in the quality of the grapes that you could have been using when it was sweeter, right? Versus when you have that dry wine, that quality really comes through. And so she really had to do that. And that, so the term brute is she come up with, like, is that French for, like, how did brute come to be the name that represents that?
The term brute was really the expression of the term dry in English. I don't know why, to be honest, but it was when we were looking for drier champagne. The brut means in French like naked or artifice. It's brut, and after brut you have nature. And Pommery was one of the first houses to put nature on the label. Nature is not a trendy word, you know, because we had nature on our bottles in the 19th century.
All right. So in the brochure that I was given, it says, whether be the first or 10th, of course, but above all be the Pommery Champagne Cellar Master. So I want to get into a little bit about you now. So how did you get into the wine industry? How did you find wine?
First of all, I was studying agronomy, biology at school. So I was more interested in biology and agronomy. And step by step, because I'm not from a wine grower family, I wasn't in that business. But step by step, with school, I made it narrower from biology to viticulture, and I studied in Montpellier, which is a quite famous school for viticulture and enology. And step by step, yes, passion was increasing. And I was very linked to my region because I was born in gardens like Mr. and Madame Pommery, and very linked to Reims. So I knew that if I work in the wine business, I wanted to work in the champagne business. And I started in the Comité Champagne, which is the interprofession of the Champagne region on technical issues. And in 2004, I joined the Pommery Group, Antoine Pommery, as vineyard manager.
Okay.
So I started in 2004 as vineyard manager, and step by step, I joined the tasting panel. So
you began by walking through the vineyards and learning the vineyard sites themselves and the quintessential what makes each vineyard its own entity, and then you just moved up ultimately to being cellar master. So,
and now a word from our sponsor. Looking to be in the know about Dracena wines? Want to know when we release our new wines? Find out about all of our accolades and get some behind the scenes information? Well, all you need to do is sign up for our newsletter. There is no commitment necessary, and I promise you we won't spam your mailbox with loads of messages. Need another reason to sign up? Quite possibly the best reason? You will immediately get a code for a special discount on all of our wines and be privy to newsletter-only specials. Let Dracena Wines turn your moments into great memories. Sign up simply by heading to our website, dracenawines.com, and fill out the pop-up or sidebar. It will take less than a minute of your time, but the rewards will last forever.
When you started in the vineyards, did you think you wanted to stay in the vineyards, or did you always,
I knew that I wanted to stay in the vineyard, and I kept the vineyard. I'm still in charge of the vineyard, yep. Which was one other part of the deal with Mr. Vanken, because the cellar master is chosen by the boss, by the owner of the company, because the cellar master has to incarnate the brand, and it's a way for the owner to give new orientations to the brand. I think my link to the terroir, to the vineyard, my commitment to environment was the decision because he wanted somebody he trusted. I was here since 15 years, and somebody involved in the vineyard because it's really important for the brand. We are probably the first wine growers in Europa because we own a lot of vineyards in Champagne, in South of France. And we can't imagine making wine without owning our vineyard. So that makes sense.
Okay. And I personally think one of the best places to figure out what wine you're going to make is by walking the vineyards. You need to be in there on a daily basis. You know, well, especially close to harvest. Maybe not. I'm not gonna lie, I'm not in the vineyard every day. But like when it's close to harvest, you need to be in there. And you need to be
tasting the berries.
There's all analytics. There's all that you can go send out to the lab to go do it. But I agree. It all comes down to the final palate. And I think that it's really cool about Champagne is that you're picking this fruit and there's so many steps down the road before you get to making it into your sparkling, into your champagne. And when you have to kind of guess forward or, you know, predict the next step and where it's going to go, because each vintage is so different. It's the rainfall is different or the sun is different. Something is different. So there is no real formula to making incredible champagne.
No, but we as I told you, there is a part of sensibility, a part of inspiration, of course. But it can be only inspiration, sensibility. You need tools. You need to have. It's not formulas, of course, but you have. You have a team. You have a strong team. Everybody has his role to play, and we have tools in Champagne very strong because we have reserve wines and the strong of a house to have a very rich, very wide collection of reserve wines. And you know, when there is a bad harvest, you can recognize. A great house by a non-vintage during a bad harvest because it's really the strength of the collection of reserve wines that makes the wine. For example, in 2017, that was a bit difficult to contain. Mm-hmm. And I was, of course, a bit worried, but I knew that I had the collection of reserve wine behind me and that it would be okay.
That all of that, once you get the wine into the cellar, okay, and you're blending, how are you determining, like, what are those blending trials like? It's got to be mind-blowing to have, because you're not only tasting this vintage, but you're tasting other vintages and pulling that wine in and saying, I want this amount of this and this and this, where, you know, like for us, we're tasting a single vintage. My blending is barrels. My blending is pulling in different, you know, wines, but they're all this vintage. You're way beyond that. So how does that even happen?
You need a lot of method and it's a long way from the harvest to the blend. You can't wake up for the morning of the blend and just taste all the because it's a combination of 100 things. So as you know, it's impossible to taste 100 things in the morning, and it's a lot of combination. So yes, in the harvest, I need to see the grapes. I need to taste the must, the juice. And it's the first feeling with the harvest. You have the tasting after the alcoholic fermentation. You have the testing after the malolactic fermentation. You have after the malolactic fermentation, we start to gather some tanks together with what we have in mind. We take a lot of notes, of course, and at the beginning, we just put the notes on the global quality and on which cuvée you think this tank can go. And this one can go in the Blanc de Blanc, this one can go in the Brut Royal, and this one in the Cuvée Louis. Cuvée Louis, to be honest, is a bit particular because the work is made before the harvest in the vineyard. But yes, and step by step, we gather the tanks for Brut Royal, for Apanage, for Blanc de Blanc, in order to make it easier during the blend. Because yes, we need 4 or 5 testing to have in mind what we will do. And the morning of the blend, you need 2 or 3 trials maximum, because it's for Brut Royal, for example, one trial it's 1.5 hours with 40 bottles on the table. So you can be too wrong. You have to.
It's and you're blending, you have a picture in your head of what this is expected to taste like, right? Because it's non-vintage, because the majority of them are non-vintage, they're typically the customer thought process is, if I'm buying a bottle in 2020, or I buy a bottle in 2022, they're tasting the same, right? So you have this picture in your head, and you try to mix and match your lots to get to
that. Yes, we have more than a picture, because the particularity of Pommery is to use the blend of the year before in the blend. In the reservoir wines, we have 2 types of reservoir wines. I think it's really particular for me. 1 half of the reservoirs are separated by variety, but by village, by fraction, cuvée, type. And one the other half is the blend. We keep the blend, we keep the Brut Royal, we keep the Blanc de Blanc, we keep the Apanage. 1 year or 2 years, for example, for the Brut Royal, we have always 2 years of Brut Royal of the year before. So in each blend, we use the Brut Royal of the year before. For example, if we use 30% of reserve wine, but that's the minimum for Brut Royal, we can put 15% of Brut Royal of the year before. Sure. That's an insurance of keeping the style
consistency
of the year. And to have the Brut Royal of the year before to taste during the blend. So it's
That helps. All right, so let's talk about the wines I actually have. So the first one I have is the Blanc de Blanc.
You have the same one? Yes, we have the same.
Yeah. Okay, yay, Blanc de Blanc. So tell me about this wine. Now, Blanc de Blanc means from white, right? All white, okay? So what about, tell us about the production of this wine, how you go about, where people can find it. Just give me all the love of this bottle.
So Blanc de Blanc means only from white varieties. So in Champagne, there are 3 main varieties covering 99% of the area. Only one is white, is the Chardonnay. I think there is a lot of Chardonnay in California too. But it's a quite rare variety in Champagne. It's less than 1/3 of the area, so that makes the Blanc de Blanc maybe more delicate to produce, because there is not so much Chardonnay in Champagne. So it's only comes from Chardonnay. It's the first blend, the first cuvée I released as chef de cave. It has been launched in May. And 2017, so it's a very recent cuvée, and we wanted to launch this cuvée and to to make something particular with this cuvée. I talk about my commitment to environment and to the terroir and to the vineyard. The idea is in this cuvée is to talk about terroir, and it's a kind of meeting between different Chauvy terroir. There are a lot of Blanc de Blanc everywhere in the world in Champagne. So the idea is to make something different. So the difficulty in this blend is to have something very fresh on the nose. So we need this for the Blanc de Blanc. Somebody who buys the Blanc de Blanc wants something fresh on the nose. But it's a Pommery, it's an appanage. Appanage is a range in Pommery for gastronomy. And so you need a structure in the wine, and you need a length and complexity. So we work on very particular villages, what we call crus. Only 10 villages from the Côte des Blancs, which is the main region for the Chardonnay, for the Grand Cru Chardonnay. But the majority of the wine is coming from the Montagne de Reims. The Montagne de Reims is a hill between Épernay and Reims, where you can find the Grand Cru of black varieties. They are more famous for Pinot Noir. For example, Verzenay are very famous for their Pinot Noir. But you can also find some Chardonnay. So the idea is to find a nice Chardonnay on the Montagne de Reims to make something different, because the Chardonnay in this region are more Pinot-like, so they are more structured. So what we want more structure, more length in the wine. And the two other terroirs are the secret of the food.
So I have to say I'm a little sad that it was 11, that we moved it to 11 a.m. because I was going to be pouring them and tasting them. But 11 a.m. four bottles might be a little rough, because I know I'm not going to want to, like, you know, save them. I'm going to continue to drink. But it would make for one heck of a Wednesday afternoon, that's for sure. All right, so we have our next label is a Brut Royal. So it is now a blue label.
To answer you, I think it has been launched very recently in the USA. So maybe not easy to find in California, but it will come very soon.
Brut Royal.
So Brut Royal is the iconic cuvée of Pommery, the flagship. Of Pommery is the cuvée you can find everywhere in the world. It's, I would say, the key to enter the world of Pommery. A lot of houses and Pommery is famous for their prestige cuvée, the cuvée Louise. But what is more difficult and what is very important to achieve the non-vintage, because everywhere in the world you will find the blue label, from Tokyo to New York to San Francisco. It has to be the same every year, so yes, it's really the key to enter the world for me, so it has to be perfect. And it's really the modern vision of the Brut of 1874. Really what Madame Pommery wanted, it's a Brut Royal. Very fresh, very elegant. So it's a selection of 40 villages, so we have more villages because we want a blend of what Champagne can offer. It's a historical villages of Pommery, from all vineyards of wine growers. It's one third of each variety, one third of Chardonnay, one third of Pinot Noir, one third of Pommery. And the idea is to find all the components of the three varieties, but without any too much differences,
variation,
harmony in the wine.
Okay, so
it's a really wine for aperitif. It's dedicated to aperitif, but you can pair it with food too. But the idea is to make a very, very nice, very fresh wine.
Okay, so it's a lighter wine, and this is the wine that they would most easily be able to find.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Now, I'm so intrigued because, again, going back to Champagne can only be made and can be called or made in Champagne, but Pommeray also makes California sparkling. Okay, and the thing that when I was first contacted, that really is what blew me away is this concept, because Champagne is so strict in, or at least to my thought process, it is so strict. I mean, you can only have your vines trained in one of four different ways. You have to train, you know, you have to pick on a certain, you know, in a certain range. You can only bottle on a certain day. You know, all of this stuff is so regulated. And here in California, I mean, for the most part, it's, you know, guns a-blazing. We can do whatever we want. You know, there's laws, but, you know, I mean, even you're drinking a Cab Franc, you know, that's, it doesn't mean it's all Cab Franc, right? It could be, right? So I'm so curious as to how the production of a sparkling wine in California from an actual Champagne house, you know, there's, how do you feel about the differences? And I know that you can make it in the traditional method and all of that. And, you know, people say that, oh, this is, but you guys are a true Champagne house making wine in California. So what do you see as the differences, whether they're easier or harder?
The Louis Pommery, the
white?
The Louis Pommery, is a global project for the brand because it's a product in California and a project in California and in the UK at the same time.
Okay.
It's really a quest of Chardonnay in the world. Pommery was trying to be in California in the 70s, but it didn't work, so it's a comeback for us in California, and of course there is not so much regulations, but as a champagne house, you know, we are using our own rules and specifications, so, but we are free to do it. But what's the difference? We are free to do it, and but we are applying quite the same rules. We are working also on a blend of different terroirs, that's the idea. But it's really a quest for Chardonnay. We are more working on Chardonnay and California. It's almost blanc de blanc. We are, if we are talking about regulation, we could have said that it's a blanc de blanc, but as there is a 5% of the terroir, we blanc de blanc for us, but we could have said it's a blanc de blanc. So yes, it's really a very precise specification from the harvest to the end. But we, as it's a new product, a new project, we can try different things we wouldn't have tried maybe in Champagne. For example, we have tried new way to make second fermentations, with encapsulated yeast. We are doing it in the UK, in California. It's also a way for us to try new things.
This production, where is this actually produced?
In Sonoma Valley.
Sonoma, okay.
We used to have a partner. We just changed the partner, but yes, the project is... We are purchasing grapes from wine growers, and we are using facilities
to produce
crush contract because we are taking time to think on what we want to do. But the idea is to apply your specification here in Sonoma, Napa.
And is the goal to, so you're saying this is a new venture. What, do you know when this started? in California?
2015.
Okay, so it is still really new. Is the goal to eventually have a house here in California? Where?
Of course, we think about it. Yeah, we in the UK, the project is different because we start by purchasing the vineyard and making the winery. Of course, maybe more difficult here in California, and it's not the same project exactly. And as we did in the UK, the idea is to try to make our blend best knowing the terroir, the different terroir. It's a bit complex in California too. There is a lot of different terroir, and we have to know better the terroir too, to know exactly where we want to go. We are exploring a lot of.
And is the winemaker here in California, is he from? Is he from?
The winemaker, he's a cellar master of Pomerie, so it used to be Thierry Vesco, the ninth cellar master of Pomerie. We worked it together. He launched Louis Pomerie California, and he just gave me the transition this year. So the idea is to have a team in Reims. I have a project manager for the sparkling wine, a winemaker. And we have also a French engineer in the UK, in New York, and who is doing the travel to San Francisco for the key stages.
Okay, very cool. And have you been able to come here?
Not yet.
Not yet?
Of course, I know California, but not since we launched because of the COVID. It's impossible to come.
Right. So, how did you choose your vineyard sites? Did people come over here and review the vineyards and decide? And do you have long-term contracts with these vineyards?
Yes, because Thierry Gasco, and I took with him, and yes, it's really there is no rule, no, in French we say a priori. Of course, you can imagine Napa better than another place, but that was really by testing, and we don't have any pre-ideas of what we have purchased, so we choose some very nice Chardonnay in the Lodi region. So it depends really on the taste, and the idea is to mix the terroir with cooler regions and maybe a more hot Chardonnay from the Lodi. So the idea is to mix really different Chardonnay.
Very cool. And what about our last bottle, the rosé? So again, this is another California. It is a Brut, but it's a Brut Rosé.
Yes, it's only 2 weeks. It has been released only 2 weeks ago.
Oh, wow.
So it's really the new one. It's a blend, as we do in Champagne. It's really a rosé with the Pomerie style. A very thin, silent pink rosé, because we wanted a rosé in which the Chardonnay is the dominating. We want elegancy, freshness, and with a lot of with nice notes of red berries, of course, but we don't want the red wine to be much present in the wine, so that's why we are using very small quantities of red wine to have this very elegant color and this elegant aromas.
And so in terms of choosing California for these, you said that you're in UK. Was there a reason why you chose California? Just because, I'm not going to lie, I think California is the best wine region there is. But, but, you know, there is...
One of the best
In the United States. But there's Oregon, there's Washington, D.C. Like, why California? Is there a relation, like, the relation in terms of what the fruit is like in Champagne versus these areas?
But Probably was in the trend of the 70s with the other houses, the French houses in California. So we knew that the region was good for sporting wines, and we know that our colleagues from other houses are making nice champagne, nice sparkling wines here in California. It's not champagne anymore, sparkling wines.
Now, actually, can you, because you are a champagne house, is there a gray area there because you are a true champagne house? But, or did you, by you had to stick to that rule, that law also? Because you are calling it California. You are not calling it champagne. You're calling it California. But
we can't.
There's no gray area.
Can't say champagne. It's forbidden. There is, yes, it's a bit difficult with USA, but as a French house, we can't say champagne or champagne méthode, so yes, it's traditional méthode. Yes, it's very important because if we don't.
I didn't know, you know, sometimes there's that little grandfather clause or the little gray area. But my guess is that Pomeray would like, even if you could have, it would be, you would want it to be a distinction. You know, it needs it there.
Yes, it's really Louis Pomery, so
it's a different label.
To pay homage to the founder, because as I told you, he died 2 years after the creation. And so we know very well Madame Pomery, so it was a great pay homage to the founder for a new project. And it's, yes, it's not something different. There is no comparison with champagne. It's a way to make sparkling wine, which express the terroir of the region. So we don't want to make champagne in the UK. We want to make sparkling wine from Hampshire with the terroir of Hampshire, and we want to do the same in California.
Excellent.
And we want to express the terroir, but with the style of Pomery.
So I have one last question about regulations and things, because this kind of always like gnaws at me a little. So even though Champagne allows 7 different grape varieties in Champagne, right? It's really only 3. Why are there the other 4? Was it used to be? Were they more prevalent at some point? Do they add something?
They have been forgotten. Some are a bit planted, like Pinot Blanc, White Pinot, or Grey Pinot, Pinot Gris. You can find some in the Côte d'Ivoire, for example. Arban and Petit Mélier are more difficult to find. We have the collection of the 7 varieties in the Clos Pompadour. You can find, you have the same, but very very small plots, but the idea is to keep the memory of these varieties, but who knows, because with the global warming, everything is changing, so we are very careful to these old varieties, because there were maybe 2 acids at one point, but maybe in 10 years, these varieties will save us, we don't know.
True. See, that's true. You've got to always be looking towards the future. You don't know. You don't know.
We have to keep the memory and test from time to time. I think there are interesting things in both varieties. For example, I planted some Pinot Gris in the UK to try. So I think Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and Meunier are so great that it's difficult to replace them. But it's a part of history and of patrimony, so we have to keep them and see what happens in the future.
Excellent. All right, well, did I miss anything? Is there something that you feel that that we should know about Madame Pomeray or about Champagne Pomeray, about you, anything?
What can I do? It's a better way to discover Pomeray is to come to see us, because the estate is amazing, the vineyards, and it's the same thing for all our products. If you have any possibilities to visit a vineyard in South of France, or rosé wine in Provence, or in Camargue, or port wine, or Douro wine in Portugal, I think for all products you need to see also, and to, because there is a lot of passion, a lot of work behind all the bottles. It's very difficult with words to express how committed we are to our products. And yes, come and visit us. I hope the Paris will let us free to do it in the future. But yes, it's very important to communicate on our vineyard, on the work we do in our vineyard, because the wine is passion, it's also conviviality, and behind label you have a patrimony story.
Thank you. All right, so I lied. I have one more question. Savoring. Have you done it? Is it a, do you think that it's us Americans kind of goofing around, or is it, something tradition? I know it's tradition.
I didn't get the water.
Oh, savor. To savor the bottle.
Savoring
the bottle.
I'm not very fan of it because... there is no reason, because it's fun. It's fun. We used to do it with if you visit us, it's a nice experience to savor in the cellars or to savor Clos Pompadour in the Clos Pompadour. It's very fun. But I'm always separated between the respect to the bottle and the fun of the
Well, I love to savor so much that my husband bought me an actual savor. I think he got
with a glass?
Yes, I have used a glass. I think he bought me the savor because he's tired of me trying to find different things around the house. I've used a stapler. If I can grab it, I've tried it.
A spoon.
I have not used a spoon.
No.
I have not used
you
a spoon. Okay, I will try. I've seen that's been kind of trending a bit, and that I don't understand. Have you seen the videos? They have it, and then they click, 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 and then they go, and I don't know why they're clicking.
I think there's no interest in.
They're just doing it. They saw somebody else.
Yeah. A way to be more confident in the.
Oh, okay.
It's really kind of fragility in the glass between the seam and the junction of the neck, and it should go very easily. If everything goes okay, it should go without looking on
without the click. I actually do really love it, but I will only do it to bottles that I'm willing to potentially lose. Because I have had a fail. I've had two fails.
It's not a problem with it's very rare, but it can fail. But
right.
Yes.
I don't think it was
more on the bottle than on you.
I think it was more that I was a little too excited to drink it, and I don't think I let it get cold enough. But because it kind of just it just kind of exploded like here, like it really exploded. So I didn't let it get cold enough. But see, I wouldn't savor this because I would be afraid that if I messed it up and it exploded, I wouldn't be able to enjoy it. So I pretty much
you can if it's well done, it should be okay. You won't lose any wine.
All right. Twist my arm. I'll have to do it for Instagram for when I drink this. But it really is a lot of fun. And there was Sidebar, this morning I watched the video. I don't know what they were talking about, but it wasn't champagne. It was just a really bad, cheap wine that they didn't have a bottle opener for, and they were blowtorching down here. What are you doing? What is the concept of that? And then the whole bottle exploded. And I was like, all right, you deserved that. But that wasn't savoring. That was just pure stupidity. But anyway, thank you so much for taking time out of your evening and out of what is, I'm sure, your very busy day to talk to me about Champagne-Pommerais. And where can people find you? Where is the best place if they want to contact Pommerais?
I think I'm not the best person to talk about sales in California, but I think you can find it in K&L Wine Merchants.
Oh, okay.
Bottle Barn, wine.com, and Bevmo and Raley's.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
Yep. Those are good.
Is okay.
Yep, those are good. Those are good. And do you know, are you on social media?
We are on Instagram, of course, and Facebook, where you can find from me on Instagram.
Okay.
No problem.
All right, so when I savor, I will be sure to tag you guys.
Yes, it'll be my pleasure.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining me. Enjoy the rest of your evening. I appreciate you sharing your knowledge, and I cannot wait to taste these champagnes. And like I said, I'm studying champagne now, so I'm so happy to have these in front of me. So thank you.
Thank you very much. It was very, very great to see you.
Good to see you too. And hopefully in real life soon. Hopefully in real life soon.
Yeah. Right.
Thank you very much. Bye. Have a good night.
This has been another episode of Exploring the Wine Glass. Thanks for listening. If you have suggestions on what topics you would like me to discuss, please reach out on social media. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as Exploring the Wine Glass. I'm also on LinkedIn as Lori Hoyt-Budd. Of course, you can always email me at exploringthewineglass@gmail.com. If you enjoyed our podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast catcher to help others find me more easily. Until next week. Sláinte.